Okay, welcome everybody. Today is February 4th, 2026, and welcome to another Wednesday webinar. I hope I'm reasonably straight here and everybody can hear me okay. Thanks for joining me, and we have over 100 people signed up for our new biology experience, so there's still some room, but hope we're thinking we're going to sell out. So this is the experience in Polyface in June, and like I say, that's going to take the place of my annual Weston Price adventure. So I will be giving a new talk, and many of the new biology practitioners and staff and everybody will be there. We're hoping to have a lot of fun and a great time, good food, and meeting a lot of good new friends. So that's the first thing. Hang on a minute. So that's the only announcement I have for today. And then I thought I would sort of inaugurate a new, I don't know if this is going to be every time, but occasionally during the week, I run across, or people send to me, or on some feed or some Telegram group I'm maybe part of, I see a science type article. So I thought I would start a new segment in the beginning, just for a few minutes, of the interesting science news of the previous week. And so I had some to share this week. So I thought I would start with that. Okay, let's do that. So hang on a minute. So I'm going to have to share my screen. I don't think I need the sound. So the first one, and this is, I'm going to focus for a minute on evolutionary biology, and there are lots of scientists these days who are calling themselves evolutionary biologists. It's sort of like leprechaun trainers, but it's a well-recognized field in modern science and biology, and they study the Darwinian interspecies evolution. And so I saw this particular piece right here, and these are you can see these oddball organisms may spawn a brand new branch of life that's now extinct. So, in other words, this is a kind of mushroom. And they're thinking, these scientists are thinking that they have spawned a whole new kind of life. And so, this I thought was very interesting. And so then I happened to run across this, which I'm sure many of you heard of, and this isn't exactly science, but the Epstein files include a message. It was, I think, a number of times Bill Clinton, who's quote, hung like a horse. So now you may think, what does that have to do with science and the first picture I showed of the giant mushroom that spawned a new form of life? And then it hit me that perhaps one of the new forms of life that this mushroom spawned was actually Bill Clinton. And so that would actually confirm the whole theory of evolution of from the giant mushroom all the way down through the millennium, through the years, and eventually coming out in Bill Clinton. So I ran this by a few of my evolutionary biology colleagues, and they seemed to think it was a plausible theory, but that I needed to find the intermediary species. It's sort of like when they make up, these different half monkeys things, like there's Lucy and a bunch of other scams through the years, and they say this is an intermediary between apes and humans. So I needed to come up with the intermediaries between the giant mushroom and Bill Clinton to make this plausible. So of course, there's a lot of research that needed to go into this, but eventually I was able to find pretty clear evidence of the what Lyons-Weiler calls the phylogenetic tree. These are the intermediate species between the mushroom and Bill Clinton. So I just wanted to show you that this is the first one. It's called Bishop's Heliconia, and you can see a picture of it there. And so apparently this mushroom morphed into, or evolved, that's a better word, into this plant, and it has brightly colored bracts, and you can see it there. And then the next step in the evolutionary journey was into the horse. And so you can see the horse there. And from there, it went right into Bill Clinton. And this, to me, is pretty convincing evidence that the Darwinian theory of interspecies evolution is not only real, but we actually have the entire phylogenetic tree going from the mushroom to the, what do you call this? The Bishop's Heliconia to the horse, and then directly into Bill Clinton. So that's what I'm going with as another example of evolutionary biology. Okay, so that was the first science article that I heard this week. The next one was a paper, and this was published January 30th, so that was like a week ago. And this was a story about the oldest fossilized dinosaur vomit discovered in Germany. And they call fossilized dinosaur vomit regurgitalite. That's a tough word to say. So they say this was 290 million years old, but this was published a week ago, so it's 290 million years plus 1 week. So that's when this dinosaur vomited up this this regurgitalite, and so you could see it there. And then they described this. So this was a carnivorous dinosaur, and they had a tummy ache, and he vomited up the contents, and then he got better and lived its best dinosaur life. This one, unlike most, actually fossilized, and it's called a regurgitalite, as you heard. And this is not to be confused with fossilized feces or poop, as you see at the bottom, which is called coprolites. So these are not coprolites. This is vomitlites. So this was another evidence for the for the history of evolution and the digestive abilities of these dinosaurs, particularly the ones that were made in the bones were made in the factory in China. Those are particularly the ones who I think seem to have the most digestive issues, and they were the ones that regurgitated many of their meals, because you know the Chinese often don't make things as well as they should, and so they ended up having digestive issues. And so they threw it up, and some of them got fossilized. So, this is, I think, a very important study in confirming the history of what's happening here. And the third one was an interesting, I think this is a little bit old, but this just came to my attention this week. This is a guy named William Fogg. Or Foggi, who you see being given the Medal of Freedom, the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barry Obama. And this was in May 29th, 2012. And this is because this Dr. Foggi, he's a doctor and epidemiologist, and he led the successful campaign to eradicate smallpox. So he's credited with saving millions of people's lives. Unfortunately, as they say, we're marking his death by letting measles come back. And I just wanted to show you basically how he did this, because he was very clever. And I'm sure some of you have seen this, But this is how smallpox came into being. Obviously, it isn't a specific disease, and we all know there's no smallpox virus. So basically, what they did was they took all these different non-specific symptoms like measles and rubella and impetigo, erythema multiforme, chickenpox, monkeypox, shingles, herpes, scarlet fever, and just non-specific dermatitis. And then in back some time ago, they called it all smallpox. So then they had an epidemic of smallpox. And the brilliance of this Dr. Foggy was he was the one who discovered, or maybe not discovered, but was popularized getting rid of smallpox, which is very simple. You just take the diagnosis of smallpox and then you break it into all these different categories. So instead of calling it smallpox, you call it chickenpox, shingles, herpes, monkeypox, scarlet fever, non-specific dermatitis, measles, rubella, impetigo, erythema multiforme. And then you say that if you've had a vaccine, you can't possibly have chickenpox, so it must be one of these. That's the same thing they did with measles. And so then measles and smallpox completely vanish. And then if you're lucky, you get awarded a Medal of Freedom for doing this very clever trick. So if anybody is really interested in looking into the whole history of smallpox, the best piece I know is a piece by Kate Sugak, Sugak. You can find it on BitChute, and it's called The Truth About Smallpox by Kate Sugak, and it's about an hour-long expose going through this and many other things in the entire history and virology, epidemiology of smallpox, and you can clearly see what a bunch of nonsense the whole thing is. So that's the science news for this week. If you happen to run across a good piece of science information, because we all want to be as up on our current science as possible, you could send it to the care team. And if you have a good piece, then hopefully I can run it and maybe put my two cents in. I'm not sure if I'm going to do this every week, but it's a little bit of fun, so we'll try to keep it going. So the next thing is, I happened to run across this piece, and just to say, when I asked the person, it was part of a Telegram group that I'm with, if he wanted attribution or to be acknowledged for writing this, he just said, yes, say it's from an anonymous smartass on a Telegram group. So that's pretty much all I know about him. And the reason I'm showing this, there isn't a whole lot new, although there are some things that are new for me, meaning it, I obviously I'm familiar with what he was saying, but I hadn't thought of it in this way. But the real reason I wanted to actually go through this in some detail is a lot of people ask me, what should I show my cousin or friend or mother, father, son, daughter who doesn't know anything about this and skeptical? And so this is a possibility. So we're going to put this in the show notes. And he said anybody is free to use it in whatever way they want. And so you can download this PDF and show it to people, and I'll go through it now, and you can see whether you think it will work for you. So let's get it a little bigger. And it's called Germ Theory, A True Underdog Story. So we already have a good sort of plot line here. So this isn't just your usual sort of scientific nonsense. This is a good story, you know, written with a good plot and everything. So, Germ Theory, A True Underdog Story. In the late 1600s, a Dutch tradesman polished glass in such a way that he obtained unprecedented magnification. This allowed him to see, quote, tiny animals within the saliva of his healthy mouth. And he was cool with that. So basically, and I'll just translate this a little bit in case anybody doesn't needs that. You probably don't. But basically, a guy in the 1600s got a microscope, or made a microscope, and he could see bacteria and fungi in the saliva of normal people's mouth. And that was fine. Over the next 2 centuries, a shift occurred, which came to be known as the Industrial Revolution. Humans began to leave their rural homes for cities, taking up difficult jobs that drained all their energy in exchange for money to buy things to distract them from how depleted they had become. Somehow they were also cool with that. So that's a pretty clear, easy, succinct description of the huge change in the way of life that people underwent not so long ago. Okay. During this period, corporations and policymakers joined forces to allow the toxic byproducts of manufacturing to be dumped into rivers and released into the air. This pollution paired nicely with the waste products of the humans themselves, long before sewage treatment strategies. So here we have a very clear, brief description of one of the hallmarks of what happened during this time known as the Industrial Revolution. Lots of pollution, lots of poisons, and lots of untreated human waste. By the early 1800s, people openly marveled that fish could even survive in their disgusting waterways, the same water they used for drinking and bathing. Some even began questioning if the rapid rise in human, animal, and plant diseases could be related. Were there new modern ways of living to blame? And if so, were corporations financially liable for the decimation of health? It's still an interesting question. Corporations in cahoots with the government, of course, corporations are government-sponsored institutions. And as I've said, they have two hallmarks which allow minor catastrophes to become in major catastrophes, and that is they shield the owners of the corporation from any personal responsibility. So nobody who's the head of these corporations actually goes to prison or has their own resources confiscated. So that is one way they get shielded by the government. The other way is that people come to realize that it's not up to them to seek redress for this poisoning that they now have had to encounter. Somehow there's a government institution or, EPA or something that they're the ones who are going to take care of it. Never mind that they're basically in cahoots and essentially owned and in a sort of incestuous relation with the corporations themselves. Okay. Suddenly, a new narrative emerged which explained everything and set all their minds and corporate balances at ease. Louis Pasteur, known for taking nature's most perfect food, milk, and heating it until it was no longer, well, natural, contributed to what soon could be known as the germ theory of disease. So there's also an interesting new book by Forrest Merriti on the whole history of milk, and this is something that has been a major focus of the Weston Price Foundation for decades. And I have read many books over the years. I started 40 years ago with a book by a guy named William Campbell Douglas called The Milk of Human Kindness Is Not Pasteurized. And in a way, that was one of the first books that got me on my current healing journey. And there was a number of other ones through the years which talked about the unfortunate rise of pasteurization, a process where they took one of nature's most perfect foods, which is milk, and heated it until it was actually disease causing. And he was also, as we know, one of the originators of what became known as the germ theory of disease. Pasteur, apparently having never learned about bacteria in healthy mouths 200 years prior, believed that humans were sterile inside and became ill when microscopic germs invaded. Although his sterile hypothesis was and still is entirely, utterly wrong, the bulk of the germ theory is alive and well today. It goes something like this. So this is an important point, which most people don't point out, and that we don't point out. The people like Pasteur, who originated the germ theory, which so many of the doctors that I know and scientists will argue until the cows come home about the germ theory, and germ theory is settled science. It's interesting to realize that the originator, the founder of this theory, one, was dead set on the fact that in a normal human being, a healthy person, there are no microscopic germs inside them, in other words, from your skin on in, and that the only so-called germs that are inside us are pathogens. This would be called laughably wrong these days. And in fact, as he points out, it was actually known to be laughably wrong 200 years before Pasteur said this. They had seen for at least 200 years that this was not the case. And so it's interesting that this guy who got essentially the fundamental observation of his own theory dramatically incorrect is still revered and thought of as somebody who originated a brilliant way to describe life and why people get sick to this day. And the processes that he inaugurated, like vaccines for anthrax and rabies and pasteurization of milk, still exists to this day, and he is still honored as being a pioneer and a essentially a kind of visionary in this whole process, even though he was clearly had no clue as to the reality. So that's an interesting way of looking at that. So then, inside of every human is an immune system that functions as a tiny microscopic army. Armies are good, and so is war. Whenever, quote, evil germs from outside the body get inside the human body, not to be confused with, quote, good germs already performing vital roles inside of the human body at all times, the immune system, quote, soldiers attack and disarm only the evil germs. And by disarm, I of course mean murder. Kill, kill, kill. So, of course, the germ theory is very similar to all the other war theories and violence. And somehow that we have this wise immune system that's our internal army that knows who the good guys are and knows who the bad guys are. And it only attacks the bad guys. And of course, sometimes there's some collateral damage, just like wars, but never mind that. It's all in good faith and all means well. And so we just are going to kill these bad guys at whatever cost. Same way of thinking as just about everything else. And since there are bad germs lurking everywhere, lurking on every surface, this war goes on every minute of every hour of every day. Just like U.S. interventionism. The good guys keep the bad guys in check, and the human host never experience symptoms of illness. So, this is a recipe for forever war, forever interventionism, And so you can see how this way of thinking has crossed over into just about every aspect of our life, and how we have been since, particularly since the Federal Reserve and the ability to print money, and therefore to do as many wars because money is no longer holding the ability to make wars in check. So now we can unleash the army to kill the bad germs on whatever surface all day and all night. And that's how we ended up with COVID. But then sometimes the immune system soldiers take naps. The invading germs sneak in quietly as microscopic ninjas and are too powerful to be stopped. Or maybe through no fault of the human, who is a helpless victim and should totally continue picking up fast food for dinner. The immune system army is just too weakened to fight. This is the part that I had never thought of before, and never being ex had explained this in the next page. So essentially what we're told is this war goes on all the time, but luckily we have an immune system that keeps the bad guys at check and essentially kills them all and somehow knows which are the bad guys and which are the good guys. But sometimes they take a nap, even though they're usually on high alert, and it doesn't have anything to do with what we how we live or anything. It's just a helpless victim. So don't worry about what you're eating or what you're thinking or what you're drinking or moving or sunlight or earthing or anything like that. Just so happened, the bad guys started to overwhelm you because the immune system got too weak to fight them off. Whatever the case, disaster strikes. The germs begin to dominate, growing stronger and stronger, multiplying exponentially, while the good soldiers get weaker and weaker. The human host experiences symptoms and becomes drained of energy. Things look bleak. Death should be imminent. So essentially, that's what we're told. The immune system got overwhelmed. The germs get stronger. They multiply exponentially. The good guys get weaker and weaker, and things look bad. That's what we're told. Alas, when all, quote, or parentheses, rational, logical hope seems lost, the tiny soldiers summon newfound strength. In spite of being far more outnumbered now than they were at the beginning of the battle, they suddenly get better at fighting. It's as if they were Neo from the Matrix, with new fighting techniques downloaded into their tiny brains. Now they know Kung Fu. And this is the, I think, the brilliant part of this piece. It's what we're told is that at the beginning, when your immune system is strong, you get this somehow, for no reason of your own, you're just a victim. The bad guys overwhelm the immune system and they start to grow, and you get weaker and weaker and sicker and sicker. And somehow, in spite of everything looking bad, they resurrect themselves for no particular reason that we know of, and they get newfound strength, and somehow they begin to be able to overcome the bad guys, even though the bad guys are now stronger and more numerous and have taken over more territory by far than they had at the beginning. But never mind any of that. Somehow now they're able to win. And we don't have any idea how that could possibly be because it's impossible, but never mind because this is science. So the silly, stupid, flawed human body, which should have just taken care of the germs from the beginning, duh, becomes the best underdog story of all time through means which will forever be a mystery, has mastered a two-part strategy. Step one. Allow the germs to get really comfortable while feeling like utter shit for a period of time. Step two, miraculously spring back to life and win the war. That's it in a nutshell. Or sometimes die. That's how it worked for the entirety of human civilization ever since we evolved from monkeys. We'd either live for 100 years or die randomly during childhood. That is until the brilliance of modern science discovered petroleum, which could be turned into chemicals and patented as pharmaceuticals. Now, at the onset of symptoms, humans can take drugs that function like a frustrated child at a chessboard, wiping out both sides at once, kill the bad guys, kill the good guys, just kill everything and start over, with only the minor nuisance of every conceivable side effect known to mankind, typed out in a 6-point font on a small piece of paper, folded 16 times, and tucked neatly within the prescription drug's packaging, otherwise known as the package insert, which describes exactly this and how these chemical pharmaceutical drugs now take the place of the resurrected immune system and allow us to live normal, healthy, victim-enhanced lives. The end. So, if you like this and you think this could be useful in helping people understand what may have happened here, please download it, and you don't need to attribute the author anything to the author of this. He wants to be anonymous, but I thought it was a brilliant and clever and easy to read, fun piece that describes basically the history in a nutshell. Okay, let me just check one thing. I think that's all I had us with that. So I just wanted to finish up with a few remaining questions that I didn't get to last time. And I think I just have three. So the first one, I don't know what I'm going to say about this. Why are people slash scientists unable to think scientifically? So this is a subject that I've obviously been banging on now for maybe months or years, that we live in a scientifically illiterate culture. So this person is asking me, why did that happen? I'm not sure I can say why it happened. I think how it happened was we systematically learned to distrust our experience and our ability to do simple, sound scientific experiments. And so, as I pointed out, since the publishing of Einstein's theory of relativity in 1905, everything became models and essentially figments of the imagination. So we live by figments of the imagination. We believe in models in theory instead of what we can see and what we can actually demonstrate with simple, doable scientific experiments that any child person can do, and it essentially is our rightful place as human beings to do these on almost a daily basis. And instead of that, we get indoctrinated into what is true based on the models of evolution and germ theory and genetics and on and on and on, all the things I talk about. And at some point, it becomes a high cost to dissent, and you will lose your job and your status. And even more so, you lose your relationship to yourself if you're not very secure in your own ability and trust. And that you can do this and you can see the truth and you can know the truth. If you don't know that, you're easily persuaded. And this is the state of pretty much all the scientists and medical doctors. And I just want to point out that, we see this in the medical doctors and in the scientists and in the health freedom community. All these people believe in the germ theory, just like this guy. Explained it right there. You can see what utter nonsense it is. And you have to realize that your doctor, the person you're supposedly entrusting your health in, he believes in this. And as I like to say, if you believe in the dinosaur thing and the germ theory, you'll believe in just about anything. Okay, next question. So what is sepsis? And maybe is there some way to treat this? We actually looked into sepsis in our new biology clinic a little bit, and I'll give you a definition in a second. And the first thing that I found about this was, even for me, and I say that, it was shocking. And so what am I talking about? So the definition of sepsis is a person with a bacterial infection in the blood. That's what I learned was the definition of sepsis. It had nothing to do with the severity of the symptoms. In other words, if you are able to document that you have bacteria growing in your blood, which is allegedly sterile, that then you have sepsis. Now, the range of symptoms that you may have range from pretty much nothing, so you're pretty much asymptomatic, to septic shock, where you drop your blood pressure and you have a significant risk of actually dying. That's what we were told. So the symptoms could be anything from almost nothing to the most extreme and then death. And so it was very clear, and we did this lots of times in the hospital and in the emergency rooms. If somebody came in particularly sick, one of the things you did was a blood culture. In other words, you drew their blood and then you sent it to the lab. And they would grow it out and see if any bacteria grew. Now, the caveat of that is you had to use very good sterile technique to obtain the blood, because the risk was you would get certain organisms which are found on the skin, like Staph epidermidis, and so that would grow out. But everybody said, well, you didn't really have staph in your blood. That was just a contamination from the skin. So there was this caveat that you had to look at the results of the culture carefully to make sure that you knew that the bacteria that was growing was actually from the blood and was not a contaminant. Once you knew that, if you had true finding of bacteria growing in the blood, the person had sepsis, and they were treated with IV antibiotics for a good period of time, usually at least a week, and usually until they had a negative blood culture. So it could even be longer than that. They were often given other things like medicines to raise their blood pressure if they were in shock, and medicines, so-called medicines to reduce their fever, etc. But those were sort of auxiliary to the main treatment, which is antibiotics. Now, interestingly, we were told, and I had seen this many times in the ER, that even with this treatment, somewhere around, we used to hear 30 to 40% of people with significant septic shock would still die. So even though that was the treatment, we all knew that it wasn't particularly successful. I mean, it was sometimes, and the people didn't die, but we didn't know for sure whether it was the treatment, because a large percentage did go on to die in spite of the, quote, best treatment available. So that was what I knew about sepsis. Now, interestingly, when we started looking at it, because there was a question I think came up in the clinic, I looked into the research on sepsis, and the first thing that shocked me was, and I don't have the paper in front of me and I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was 40% of the people who they diagnose with sepsis have negative blood cultures, which means they have no evidence for bacteria in the blood. They have maybe shock, and maybe they even go on to die, and maybe they have other dramatic symptoms, but they don't have bacteria growing out in the blood culture. And The reason that shocked me was because I had learned that the definition of sepsis was a positive blood culture. So if the blood culture was negative, it doesn't mean they don't have a serious problem, but it did mean they don't have sepsis, and that you had no evidence that a bacteria infection was the so-called cause of this problem. And so to go on and say that some percentage, even 1%, of people who you still make the diagnosis of sepsis but have a negative blood culture means the whole thing is complete nonsense. Because if they have a negative blood culture, they don't have sepsis, according to the definition. So to call it sepsis means you've changed the definition of the word until the word is completely meaningless. So all you can say is person very sick. That's it. You have no idea why they're sick. And it obviously isn't related or isn't proven to be a cause by the bacteria of whatever sort, because if 40% don't even have bacteria, by your best efforts at finding them, then that cannot be the cause of this phenomena. And that's part of thinking scientifically, which seems completely obvious, but somehow evades most doctors and scientists. So that means there's some other reason, and obviously we all probably by now know the reason, and it was described in this PDF. The person is poisoned and they have all kinds of toxic debris in their blood. So that's like the worst kind of poisoning. So it's actually literally you're being poisoned in your blood, whether it's because of pharmaceuticals or vaccines or breathing stuff that has made its way into your bloodstream or eating stuff or whatever or thinking. And so your blood is actually in some ways kind of deteriorating. And so sometimes you'll get bacteria that come to try to help you out to essentially try to clean up the debris in your and the dead material even in your bloodstream. And that's what we call sepsis. And it is a severe problem, and some of the people will even die. Interestingly, there has been a significant body of research showing that if you simply give people intravenous vitamin C in high doses, like 100 grams maybe every 6 to 12 hours, that you significantly reduce the mortality from even the most severe sepsis. So that's probably what I would do, a detoxification, high dose vitamin C kind of treatment to try to get rid of the deterioration and the poisoning that is the problem. It's not the bacteria, because even in 40% of the time, there isn't even a bacteria. They're not the problem. They're the cleanup crew. As always, the germ theory has so misled people that they even can't see it when it's obvious, meaning when 40% of the people don't even have a bacteria in their blood, that they can't look for any other cause, like is the person being poisoned? Are they not breathing? Are they been in, shot up with some sort of vaccine or something? That's the problem. And if you think like that, you should be able to help at least most of the people with this, even though I would admit it's a serious problem, which does need some immediate attention. Okay, and the final question, why do babies get diarrhea if not rotavirus? So again, the specific way to ask this question actually should be, we know there's no such thing as viruses. We know there's no such thing as rotaviruses, or you could put it more specifically, nobody has ever demonstrated the existence of a virus, any virus. So that obviously includes a rotavirus. And so if something doesn't exist, it can't possibly be the cause of an illness. So, given that, and that we know that it cannot possibly be a rotavirus, by the way, This isn't funny, but in a we used to sort of joke when they because I was around when they started introducing the rotavirus vaccine, which we used to call the intussusception vaccine, which means particularly in the early days, there was a huge percentage of people, huge, not like 20, but like 0.1%, which is huge for a horrible side effect like intussusception. Intussusception means the bowel telescopes on itself. It's like folds into itself. And that is a horrible problem, which some infants even will die. And you usually have to go down with a scope and push the intestine back out where it telescoped in. Otherwise, they get their bowel essentially dies and they get horrible diarrhea and it's a nightmare. And nobody that I knew or heard of had ever seen a case of intussusception except as a result of the rotavirus vaccine. So that's why we called it the intussusception vaccine. Nobody should get a rotavirus vaccine. There is no evidence for a rotavirus, first of all, and it was a horrible vaccine. Maybe they cleaned it up a little bit since, but there's no use for it or any other vaccine. So why do babies get diarrhea? Because, and usually this happens in so-called poor or malnourished places. The babies are not fed properly. Their water isn't clean. Their social environment is terrible. They're getting all kinds of injections, and their birth process was not natural. All the usual reasons of poisoning, starvation, social disruption, emotional traumas. A lot of this happens in countries where they poison the air and the water with different chemicals for mining and other sort of extraction purposes. And so you end up with poisoned water and poisoned food, and babies who aren't nursing properly, or the mothers are malnourished, and social disruption, and the babies respond by trying to poop out some of these toxins, and we call that diarrhea. And it's a serious problem, and it can only be fixed by cleaning up the environment of these children and letting them live normal, healthy, happy lives, which should be the case for all people living on Earth. Okay, I finally got through all the questions, and I finished a little early. So thanks everybody for joining me. And if you have any science articles that I can look at next week, I'd be happy to take a look. I hope everybody stays warm, has a good week, and I will see you next week.